looking to the Turkish strategy, policy regarding the coalitions. They have their own interest, very different interest to the American interest. This is the case. We are familiar and we suffer from it. But, you know, we can manage finding all kind of common interest with others, like the Sunni Arab camp. So by saying it, the developing situation is producing opportunities, not just risks. And we believe that we know how to exploit it. And
how do you exploit it?
You know, having a cooperation with all those who are ready to cooperate.
Well, my question is, where does that lead you to? I mean, you're saying we've got friends. We've got new friends.
Saudi Arabia, the Emirates.
So tell me what that impact of that on the ground is.
We can go back to the Prime Minister's speech here in the General Assembly recently.
Right.
When he was talking about the political horizon, he didn't talk about Abu Mazen in Ramallah. The way to political horizon in the region is not in Ramallah, but is going via some other capitals in the region to our mind. But in order to reach it, it's another problem which we call it misconceptions. Those who believe that when we talk about a peaceful situation, we have to look to official, formal agreements written by lawyers. We don't believe in it. We believe in interests.
Yes.
It might be big sticks in the region. Anyhow, you need big sticks.
Yeah. Who is it once
and
said?
Carrots. Sharing common interests, common enemies. That's the best way to manage the political situation in the region.
So what else you're saying is that if we're forced to attack Iran, we think we can count on these aforementioned countries to be supportive covertly of what we did.
I don't want to discuss this scenario, but anyhow, Iran is a common enemy. What about ISIS? What about Al-Qaeda? What about the Muslim Brotherhood is a common enemy? Hamas was not supported by those Sunni Arab countries, neither by Egypt nor by Jordan, Saudi Arabia, United Arab Emirates, and so forth. So, interesting.
Israel's new best friends.
Might be.
Do you think of the United States as in the same place as all the above-mentioned countries are? Because after Mubarak and after Damascus and Assad's crossing red line, there was, it is publicly acknowledged, some questioning of America's commitment. Has the president's trip to see King Abdullah and other events caused those countries to say, we're reassured now. Whatever question we had, we know America's prepared to do the right thing?
It might be, but anyhow, the United States is our best ally.
Israel's best ally.
Yeah, no doubt about it. Mm-hmm. And, of course, we enjoy the relationships, the cooperation between the two defense establishments, the Pentagon, the Ministry of Defense, the U.S. Armed Forces, led by General Dempsey, and the Israel Defense Forces, led by General Gantz, and the cooperation in the between the
and
intelligence
Defense
agencies.
Forces led by you.
Israel Defense Forces are led by me, yes, by us, yes, sure. So, and no doubt that the United States is our best ally, and this is the most powerful party all over the globe regarding military might, economic power, and political power. On certain issues, we share a couple of disputes, but we have the channels to discuss.
Where is the dispute on issues? Well, settlements clearly is a disputed issue, but I mean, there was a dispute as to how far you went in Gaza, too. You went more and you did things that they didn't want you to do. It doesn't seem to stop you if the President of the United States publicly acknowledges their differences and privately urges you to stop.
I prefer to discuss the disputes in closed doors. It's the relationship is too important to do it publicly.
Yeah. But publicly, you and others say your ambassador, all say on the national security level, the cooperation military to military has never been better.
That's right.
Correct?
Absolutely.
So what do you worry about?
You know, might be disputes about the Iran issue, which we discussed,
yeah,
about what should be done on the Israeli-Palestinian track, which came out and publicly, unfortunately, and so forth and so forth.
You've denied saying something about John Kerry. I'm not sure you've denied it, or basically you said nobody heard me say that, so therefore. What did
That's
you
right.
What are you alleging? What? That's correct.
It's nobody heard me saying it.
So therefore, nobody can say you said it. You haven't denied saying it. You just simply say nobody heard me say that.
You know, we have, as I said, very good relationship. We appreciate
the U.S. efforts
on any issue.
You've already said
it
that.
It doesn't mean that we don't have disputes on certain issues.
So what was wrong with Secretary Kerry trying to find a way to get a peace agreement between Palestinians and Israelis? I mean, do you accept the idea if there could be a peace treaty between Israel and Palestinians that gave the Palestinians their own state, it would, and Israel's national security was secure, that's a good thing?
Theoretically, you are right, but I have the experience with the Palestinians for more than 20 years.
Which tells you what?
And unfortunately, the international discourse regarding the Israeli-Palestinian conflict is dominated by too many misconceptions.
Which
one of them is, you know, what is the call for instability in the Middle East? There's also claims it is the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. We strongly deny it.
I understand.
The uprising in Tunisia and the revolution, counter-revolution in Egypt,
right,
and the ongoing civil war in Syria and the situation in Iraq. It's not because of us. It's not because of the Israeli president.
Granted,
let's leave it alone.
Fair enough.
And the next misconception is regarding the core of the conflict. What is it all about? Whether it's territorial, to be concluded along 67 lines, which personally I supported.
Exactly.
I supported personally Oslo.
I know it.
But when I realized and I found that we don't have a partner on the Palestinian side, neither Arafat at that time, nor Abu Mazen now, not talking about Hamas, we're ready to recognize our right to exist as a nation state of the Jewish people in any boundaries, I realize that we should find another way, not just talking about 67 line Palestinian state.
Right.
And actually,
Jerusalem
they enjoy political independence. They have already two political entities, one in Gaza, led by Hamas, Hamastan, and one in the West Bank,
yeah,
led by
Abu Mazen. Yeah, but that's changing, it seems like. But
it might be changing, but nevertheless, they enjoy political independence. That's fine. We don't want to govern them.
Okay, but you seem to be saying, I no longer believe in a two-state solution. That seems like what you're saying.
First of all,
that they have their own independence already, so therefore they don't need a state. Is that what you're saying?
You might call it a state. You might call it the Palestinian Empire. It's going to be an autonomy. It's going to be demilitarized. And yes, in order to encourage them, as we don't want to govern them,
but why don't
they should be competent to govern themselves. Let's deal with that.
Your prime minister says he believes in a two-state solution.
You might say everything. I believe in the Palestinian Empire. What does it mean? It's going to be an autonomy.
But can't you call it a state?
Are they ready to recognize our right to exist as a Jewish state? Are they ready? Have you heard it from Abu Mazen, from Arafat, not talking about Hamas? And this is the core of the conflict. They believe that 67 lines is just a stage. Their ambition is not to have a Palestinian state. Otherwise, they would have had it, because Annapolis proposal, Camp David proposal, Oslo proposal, even the UN partition plans proposal of 47.
Okay.
They rejected all of it because their aim is not to have a Palestinian state in 67 lines, but to destruct the Jewish state. This is the idea. That's why they don't say even two states for two peoples. They deny the existence of the Jewish people.
Do you believe that is the position of Abbas?
Absolutely.
Can you
quote him saying that he is ready to recognize our right to exist as a nation state of the Jewish people, or to consider territorial compromise as the end of conflict and finality of claims? You can't quote him saying it. And this is a tricky way of Abbas.
Okay, but let me ask you this. at Camp David, when Ehud Barak was negotiating, was a recognition of a Jewish state part of the negotiations?
No.
So that you
no.
No, but you no. added that later.
No, we didn't edit it later. Rabin tried to put it in Oslo.
Yeah.
And he failed. So his condition to agree to Oslo was to get a side letter from Arafat, in which Arafat was committed to change the Palestinian charter in a way that it would be a recognition of Israel as a Jewish state. And he didn't do it. He didn't do it. Why didn't do it?
Arafat didn't do it.
Arafat didn't do it.
He didn't do it because?
Because he didn't want to recognize our right to exist as a Jewish state. And the other maneuvers to avoid it just demonstrate their ideology. This is the ideology. Why Abu Mazen is not ready to say even two states for two peoples? He doesn't recognize the existence of the Jewish people. He claims Judaism being a religion. It's neither nationality nor peoplehood.
But they almost,
so why should
but he almost,
the religion have a state?
But he came to an agreement, which they later failed to move forward on, with Ehud Olmert, then the prime minister.
He escaped it. Again. Like they escaped Camp David.
Because they do He's, not want a deal.
Absolutely. In what? A way that will be a conclusion of the conflict within 67 line. They want more. So he's not ready to make the critical decision.
Yeah, you give
but
up.
He's in a position to blame us because it is not well understood, even by our allies.
If, in fact, all the things that are separate Israel and the Palestinians now, 6 or 7 borders, which you said I'd be okay with, plus the right of return can be fixed. I'm not sure about Jerusalem as a center of government for the Palestinians. They want part of East Jerusalem as the center of their government. Could you ever accept that?
No.
No?
No, their intention is not so to have a Palestinian state. As long as this is the case, and you know, I served as the head of the intelligence under late Mr. Rabin, 95. And I came to Mr. Rabin in August 95 saying, you know, I have to warn you, this is a strategic early warning.
This is?
Strategic early warning.
Okay.
I don't see Arafat preparing his people for reconciliation, coexistence with us. In contrary, he prepared them for jihad and istishad, holy war and martyrdom. And I realized it not because of my sophisticated intelligence sources. I just have to look to the Palestinian educational curriculum. And this is the case still now. Looking to the way that they educate the young generation. If 3-year-old kids are educated to wear explosive belts, to kill whom? To hate the Jews. I'm not talking about Hamas, I'm talking about Fatah, about the Palestinian Authority educational curricula. If this is the case, what are we talking about? This is the way to encourage, to promote peace. And that's the way that we should concentrate in. And it's not going to come by unilateral decisions on the Security Council or the General Assembly. It should be worked, I call it, from the bottom up. As we don't want to rule them, as we don't want to govern them, we want them to enjoy
But answer me the question, do you want them to have a state?
To have a they call it, it will be an autonomy.
I'm not trying to play games with you. I'm trying to understand where you are. I mean, you don't want them, you don't want to call it a state. You don't want to say the Palestinians have a state.
It should be discussed in negotiations. But really, it's going to be autonomy. Can they survive without...
What's the difference in autonomy and a state? I don't understand.
Call it an empire. It doesn't matter. It has become a term which is discussed.
Call it a state with
You can call it whatever.
Okay, call it a state with membership in the United Nations.
You can call it whatever.
And recognized by other states. And if you want to deal with Palestinians, you go to the state of Palestine to deal with them and where their capital is and where their diplomats is and where their head of government is.
I will be ready to discuss it when they recognize our right to exist as a nation state of the Jewish people. This is not the case, so I'm not ready to discuss it. Nevertheless, can they be really independent? Talking about the economy, they are dependent on us. Talking about infrastructure,
and
electricity,
and
water, they are dependent on us. That's fine.
Some would argue that if, in fact, there had been somebody at the time of Rabin, and when his hopes were there, you know, that if, in fact, you could have found a way to find an agreement then, after Rabin and Arafat came over to see the President of the United States and at the Clinton. White House,
yeah.
Clinton, that if we could have had an agreement and built on it, you now, because of economic reason and because of all kinds of developing relationships, Israel and the Palestinians would be in a much better place today.
But again, it's not going to be a state in a way that you imagine it. It should be, it should be, the Paris Agreement means that the shekel is the money, the currency, the official currency. You can't have in such a tiny place with all the problems to have their own economy. They're not going to have viable economy without us. They are dependent on us. And this is a case in terms of security. You know that we foiled a terror cell led by Hamas recently in last summer, 96 terrorists, intending to overthrow Abu Mazen. We saved him. So this kind of cooperation, living together,
beyond
economy, security, it means autonomy. Let's have their own government, their own parliament, their own municipalities. They enjoy it already, political independence. But they'll militarize and so forth. So it is not a state as you imagine, but this is the only way to live together.
This is Philip Stevens. Israel is losing its friends in the world. Again, misconceptions.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. You know, we were ready for compromise. I personally supported Oslo, as I said.
I know you did.
But with this experience with the Palestinians, in which any territory, any piece of territory which was delivered to the responsibility, had become either safe haven for terrorists, homicide bombers launcher, until we moved from the defense to the offense in Defensive Shield Operation 2002, we suffered from homicide bombings all over the country, more than 1,000 casualties. Or rockets launching pads, as we witness now in the Gaza Strip. With this experience in mind, do you believe that the only way is to withdraw? What did we get from our withdrawal?
From Gaza.
Terror,
from
Gaza, yeah. And from Jenin and Nablus, you know, the areas that we delivered to the responsibility
in the
West Bank.
So you don't ever want to give up the West Bank?
You know, we are ready to discuss all issues. We gave up the areas which are now considered areas A and areas B. But I can't imagine in the current situation any restrictions to our freedom of operation in the current situation in the West Bank. Otherwise, we want to see Hamastan with Palestinian Islamic Jihad and global jihad elements.
Suppose you are a young Palestinian in Gaza or in the West Bank, and you hear the defense minister, a man with a distinguished career, in Israel, and who, as you said, supported Oslo, who's willing to do things, say what you just said. Does that give any hope to them?
Yes. They enjoy political independence. We are ready to promote.
They can elect the leaders they want.
To support.
So if they elect people who support Hamas, then more power to them. It's their choice.
They have now the right to vote to their parliament, to elect their government.
But that's what happened in Gaza. That's what happened in Gaza. They elected the Hamas.
Okay, let's wait and see what they'll elect in the West Bank. But nevertheless, we are encouraging, promoting the economy from the bottom up, allowing them to live in dignity and to enjoy well-being. This is not the case with Hamas in the Gaza Strip. This is the case in the West Bank now. And we encourage it. This is a way to have hope in the future. Otherwise, their intention is very different. Not to live independently, but to destroy us, to kill us. If this is the case, you know, anyhow, it's not any concession is not going to be useful.
As you know, there are arguments about what happened in Gaza, and some will argue, notwithstanding all the damage and all the casualties, that Hamas won because they survived.
Yes, you know, the the white flag of Hamas and Hezbollah is something like that.
Victory.
Yes. At the end, they accepted the Egyptian initiative that they rejected from the very beginning. I understand them. Why did they reject the Egyptian initiative? It's not in their favor. Nevertheless, they paid a very heavy price for the ongoing provocations, launching more than 4,500 rockets and mortar shells on our civilians. And as we had to respond to defend our people, and they did it from densely populated area in the Gaza Strip.
Everybody recognized your right to defend yourself. Okay. Everybody did. I mean, they may call into question whether you went further than you had to go, but they recognize your right to defend yourself. Everybody, I think. But yeah, they survived, and they're rebuilding. They just got $5 or $6 billion from donor nations to rebuild.
We support any idea of reconstruction in Gaza and improving the economy of Gaza.
How about a seaport and an airport?
Not at all, because we can't trust them. If they have seaport and airport, it will be very easy for them to smuggle, it's not smuggling, to import rockets and missiles from Iran or from other parties in the region. And, you know, we disengaged from Gaza 2005 to address their territorial grievances. That was the idea in the government. I rejected it as the chief of staff at that time because I understood that it's going to create an Islamic state.
Yeah. In other words, you did not want to leave Gaza.
What does it mean to leave Gaza? What we had in Gaza, it's another misunderstanding. We had the Gazans living in Gaza, Khan Yunis, Rafah. We were not involved there. We didn't deploy there. They enjoy their autonomy, let's say this way. We had settlers in the Katif cluster, isolated, not confiscating Palestinian land, actually providing work. 3,700 Palestinians were employed in the settlements. 4,500 Palestinian families enjoy the Erez industrial zone. They decided to destroy it. It's another fact which demonstrates the willingness whether to live together, coexistence, reconciliation, or to fight. That's another example. Now, when we withdrew from the Gaza Strip, they had the option to spend the money on the economy, to grow strawberries, right, to export strawberries, and not to manufacture and export rockets. But they choose the way of the rockets. That's why we have to keep them and to take the security measures.
So, in other words,
cause them certain problems.
Your opinion on the West Bank is informed by what you saw happen in
Absolutely.
Gaza.
Absolutely. And what I saw in the West Bank when we withdrew from Jenin, Nablus, to become another cities, Areas A in the West Bank, which had become to be homicide bombers launcher. Just when we moved to the offense, and since Defensive Shield Operation 2000, we enjoy the freedom of operation, then we enjoy now relatively calm situation because of our activities.
What could change your mind so that you would be supportive of a Palestinian state along the 67 borders and not even worrying about all the other elements, right? What could change your mind?
Educational reform. Looking to the textbooks, seeing that there is no anymore education for hatred, there is education for peace, like in our side. This is the way that we educate our kids in Israel. And of course, the political leadership rhetorics, according to this change which is needed. And education is the first signal for me to start to trust the option of having peace with them. Otherwise, we should keep the modus vivendi by cooperating, by keeping the economy, but ready to fight any threat generated, whether from the Gaza Strip or from the West Bank.
Thank you for coming. It's a pleasure to meet you.
Thank you.
State is jump-starting business with Startup New York, an unprecedented program that partners businesses with universities across the state for better access to talent, cutting-edge research, and state-of-the-art facilities. And you pay no taxes for 10 years. From biotech in Brooklyn to next-gen energy in Binghamton to manufacturing in Buffalo, Startup New York has new businesses popping up across the state. See how Startup New York can help your business grow at startup.ny.gov.
Let's hide in the attic.
No, in the basement.
Why can't we just get in the running car?
You crazy? Let's hide behind the chainsaws.
Smart. Yeah, okay.
If you're in a horror movie, you make poor decisions. That's what you do.
I'm being quiet.
You're breathing on me.
If you want to save 15% or more on car insurance, you switch to Geico. It's what you do.
Sailing through the heart of cities and landscapes with Viking, you'll see things differently. You'll get closer to iconic landmarks, to local life and cultural treasures. It's a feeling that only a river can give you, that only Viking can give you. Spend less time getting there and more time being there. Viking River Cruises, exploring the world in comfort.
How do you start your day so you make better investment decisions?
You watch Bloomberg Surveillance to find out what the markets are doing. And you talk to smart people. Bloomberg Surveillance, weekdays at 6 a.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Television.
I was an alcoholic.
I was addicted to OxyContin.
I was a heroin addict.
I was a cocaine addict.
I was addicted to crack.
Over 23 million Americans suffer from addiction. It's a disease that destroys lives, relationships, and careers, and it's now causing more deaths than auto accidents. It doesn't just go away on its own, but it is treatable. Get help. Get help now. Call the Addiction Advisor and talk to one of their compassionate advisors. They are there for you 24 hours a day. Get the help you need. The call is free, and so is the service. Call the Addiction Advisor now.
Addiction is a disease that can be treated. Our compassionate advisors will listen without judgment and provide you with options. The call is free, and so is the service. We're here for you 24 hours a day.
Call 800-260-1345. That's 800-260-1345.
Some come here to build something smarter. Some come here to build something stronger. Others come to build something faster, something safer, something greener, something the whole world can share. People come to Boeing to do many different things, but it's always about the very thing we do best.
Partnerships occur when both share a passion for improving, for growing in harmony. Speak from the heart and respect the other. Feeling of being comfortable, of being open, that creates the true partnership, which ensures the greatest success. Together, invest in remarkable Indonesia.
I'm John Heilman.
And I'm Mark Halpern. With all due respect to all y'all in Nashville,
I'm sports.
sports fans in tonight's lineup. Chris Christie does the bare minimum. Gene Shaheen is taking things for granted. And Charlie Crist will debate without his number one fan. But first, Josh Earnest was on this show a couple weeks ago, shortly after President Obama said that although his name was not on the ballot this fall, his policies are. Mark, you bet Josh $100 that the president would never say that again. But last night, Obama sort of did, telling Al Sharpton the Democrats in red states are, quote, all folks who vote with me, they have supported my agenda in Congress. Josh Earnest may have won a C note from you, Halperin, but his prize today was he had to try to clean up his boss's mess.
The success of many of these Democratic candidates will depend on their own success in motivating voters that strongly supported the president in 2012.
Mark, I can't imagine there's a Democratic candidate in the country who was happy with what President Obama said last night. Why on earth did he say what he said?
Well, first of all, it's not exploded as a story. It was not in a lot of the morning papers. It's not been huge in the coverage so far, but I suspect we'll see it in Republican ads. You know, it would take more of a psychoanalyst than a political analyst to say for sure, but I think the president is proud of his record, and particularly when he's speaking to African-American radio or groups within the Democratic Party who still are really enthusiastic about him. I think he just wants to be out there saying what he believes is true, which is he's got a great record that a lot of Democrats have supported.
Right. And I think there's also some truth in a funny way to what Josh Earnest is saying there, which is that this is a delicate balance, right? There are places where the president is a motivator for the Democratic base and for people who were part of the president's coalition in 2012. They need those people to get out if they're going to have a chance in those races. He can't go and personally campaign for them because it would turn off too many undecided voters, but he's still trying to stay away but still be a motivating force for those voters they need to win.
But make no mistake, it's not a good thing that he said it for his party, and there are a lot of Democrats who are annoyed with it. And let's see how much it comes up in the next couple of days in ads and Democrats in the trail being reminded of the one thing Republicans want to remind voters above all else, that their opponents voted to support President Obama.
Right. They all have records. They're on the record, and those records were pretty well known already. Anyway, okay. If it was President Obama last night performing his version of Oops, I Did It Again, today it was the Republican headliner, Chris Christie, who grabbed the mic and started singing off-key.
I got to tell you the truth. I'm tired of hearing about the minimum wage. I really am. I don't think there's a mother or father sitting around a kitchen table tonight in America who are saying, you know, honey, if our son or daughter could just make a higher minimum wage, my God, all our dreams would be realized.
Mark, Chris Christie is not Barack Obama, but we still thought we should ask Governor Christie's office if they had any comment about his comment. And his spokeswoman emailed, quote, nothing to say beyond the governor's own words on this. This isn't something he said for the first time, though. There's no doubt this is the kind of thing that will blow up and certain quadrants of the liberal media and liberal blogosphere, people will focus on this. But it seems to me there's no chance that this is going to resonate in races across the country in the way that President Obama's might. I don't know. What do you think about that?
I agree. No chance it'll resonate because this is Chris Christie being Chris Christie, and it makes me Ed Grimley mental when one party attacks a thing like this. I mean, we know what he meant. It's not like he's opposed to a federal minimum wage. He was making a legitimate point. I cannot stand this part of our politics where you have Democrats jumping on a presumed or alleged gaffe like this. Democrats were rightly outraged when Republicans tried to make a big deal about the president saying you didn't build it. I have no sympathy now for Democrats trying to make this a big issue. Yes, they can debate the minimum wage with Christie, but please, this is not a gaffe. It is not reflective of anything.
Right. There's no doubt, though, that it is reflective of, there is one truth, which is that the Republican Party largely is on the other side of the minimum wage issue from the Democratic Party, and that Democrats have a huge advantage with the electorate on that. So forgetting about the soundbite itself, they should be driving this issue. They want to try to get back on that mission, on that message, because it helps them and try to get to distract attention away from the other things that are cutting against them. But this bite itself is ridiculous.
I'm all for a debate about the minimum wage, but that's not what this is about.
I agree.
Ridiculous.
Totally agree. Freak show politics, and we'll see it play out over the next few hours. All right, moving on to our next Senate race to watch. The one tonight is in New Hampshire. The Democratic incumbent Gene Shaheen and the Republican challenger Scott Brown will have their second debate this evening in Concord. Mark, this race for weeks has seesawed back and forth. It's been very, very tight. Senator Shaheen looks like she has a few points lead in the most recent polling, but she's well within the margin of error. Do you think that Scott Brown is still the underdog in this race, or is this now race effectively a toss-up?
He's still the underdog. I think the debates in this race are huge. It's such a politically sophisticated state. The first debate was not on television. The next ones are. And I think Brown has got to get Jean Shaheen rattled in order to put himself in parity in this race. They're both going for independence, always huge in New Hampshire. I think she performed so well last Thursday night at the Jefferson Jackson dinner. I was really impressed. If she shows the kind of poise and humor and confidence in the debate tonight and the next two debates, as she did in that dinner, I think Brown will get close, but only win if there's a national wave, not control of his own destiny.
Right. This has always sort of been her race to lose. And for a little while, it looked like he was on offense, she was on defense. She seems to be kind of back now. She's got a strong set of messages attacking him on energy, attacking him on being a Wall Street fat cat. She's got Elizabeth Warren coming up to the state to help her out. I feel like if she puts in a really good debate performance tonight, I think I agree with you. If she puts in a very strong debate performance tonight, I think this is one where Scott Brown is likely to fall a little bit short, but we'll see.
She hasn't lost very much in her career. She did lose one Senate race to John Sununu. I think the strength of Brown that he's underrated on is he's been very disciplined. He's taken a lot of hits, and he's driven a pretty good message. His speech on Obamacare was one of the best Republican speeches on Obamacare politically that I've heard. The thing about him is he's going up against someone who is a proven vote-getter in the state, and he's still facing questions about the core issue the Democrats have tried to ride, which is about the fact that he used to be a senator from Massachusetts. But these debates matter a ton because, as I said, in this state, if either of them makes a mistake, they're high stakes. Every politically savvy voter in the state, which is most voters in the state, are going to hear about it.
Right. Everybody focuses on the carpetbagger issue, but the truth is it's just that New Hampshire is really different from Massachusetts. And so even if he doesn't get dinged from being a, quote, carpetbagger, the truth is he is not what she is, as you point out, a proven vote getter in that very complicated, very sophisticated little state. And that's obviously to his disadvantage in the final days.
Yeah, stylistically, she is a current senator, even though he's been a senator, and he's really trying to pound on tying her to the president, tying her to Washington. I bet we hear both those things, no surprise, a ton in the debate tonight.
All right, moving on to our last topic for this block. Now we're going to talk about Jacksonville, Florida, where the governor of that state, Rick Scott, will debate his challenger, Charlie Crist, again after last week's debate was consumed with controversy over Crist's self-cooling apparatus. This time, Crist is not allowed to bring the vaunted fan that travels with him virtually everywhere. So we put our top climatologists on the story and pored over the research. Here's what they found out. First of all, it's hot outside in Jacksonville, and by 9 p.m., the humidity could reach 79%, a scorching near 80%. Inside the studio where the debate will take place, the TV station says it will be cooler, but nothing like the Ed Sullivan Theater cold, around the low to mid-60s. And finally, not only is there a fan ban, but we've learned through our assiduous reporting that there will be no dehumidifier or any other electronic device allowed inside the hall. Mark, given these conditions, I think there is a reasonable chance that Charlie Crist is going to melt. What do you think?
The hottest thing in that room will be CNN's Jake Tapper, one of the moderators of the debate. Look, there's going to be a ton of focus on the fan. I'm sure there'll be fan jokes. But this thing is one of the biggest races in the country. Beyond the Senate races, who's governor of Florida is a really big deal. Most people think the race is basically tied. I think Scott is got to prove to him, prove to voters tonight he deserves a second term. Crist is a cagey and underrated politician. I think this is going to be, down the last 2 weeks, one of the biggest, highest-profile races in the country. This debate is a big deal, no question.
It is a huge deal. I think that it is. Like, the polls literally, I think, have it at 44-44 right now. It couldn't really be any tighter. It's been a pretty dispiriting campaign for a lot of people. Not a lot of issues in play. A lot of negative campaigning. A lot of mudslinging. It's just been very desultory. I can't imagine a lot of Floridian voters will go in an inspired way to the ballot box on this one, but it does matter a lot.
If Crist melts, I'll give Josh Earnest another $100.
Okay, well, you can afford that. All right, coming up, the man who was the answer time and again to a question posed to every First Lady: who are you wearing?
Bloomberg's With All Due Respect is brought to you by Koch Industries. Learn more at KochCareers.com.
Koch Industries started in the heartland, and we've expanded to nearly every state. Today, that's more than 60,000 American jobs. You may not always see our name on the products you use, but we help make better food, clothing, shelter, technologies, and other necessities. Here, we build on each other's ideas to create more opportunities for people everywhere. Together, we are Koch.
Gunderman Group, Gutterman Group is growing.
Getting in a groove.
Growth is gratifying.
The goal is to grow.
Gotta get greater growth.
I just talked to UPS. They've got expert advice, special discounts, new technologies, like smart pickups. They'll only show up when you print a label, and it's automatic. We save time and money.
Time?
Money?
Time and money.
Awesome.
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 I love logistics.
This is the storm.
There's a storm coming.
That whipped through the turbine, which poured surplus energy into the plant, which generously lowered its price, and tipped off the house, which used all that energy to stay warm through the storm.
There's a bad storm coming.
The Internet of Everything is changing how energy works. Is your network ready?
Try the new Bloomberg Business Week Plus app for Samsung phone and tablet and get your first year of Bloomberg Business Week free. You'll get deeper intelligence on global business, innovative companies, technology trends, and exclusive behind-the-scenes videos and interviews. Start your free Bloomberg Business Week Plus subscription on your Samsung device today.
We know our most famous political figures by their speeches, their votes, and their campaigns. Oscar de la Renta knew them by their fashion tastes and measurements. The dean of design, who had a special relationship with those at the pinnacle of power, was 82 years old when he died yesterday after a long fight with cancer. And the Washington Post's Robin Givhan has written an ode to his delicate grasp of women's dress. She joins us now. Robin, can you talk about how Oscar de la Renta became the go-to clothier to so many first ladies, from Jackie Kennedy and Nancy Reagan to Laura Bush and Hillary Clinton?
Well, you know, sort of the first rule of thumb for first ladies is that they turn to American designers for, that has had always been the case. They turn to American designers for their public wardrobe. And Oscar de la Renta, I think, occupied a really sweet spot between creating clothes that would appeal to the private woman and her particular sensibility, but would also fill this public role that she was compelled to carry out. And it's a tough line to walk because we do expect a certain regalness in first ladies, but we also expect them to be relatable. And that's a tough balancing act.
Robin, most of the recent first ladies not just wore his clothes, but have, since his death, talked about loving him and clearly had an emotional bond with him. Why has Michelle Obama not followed the pattern of being someone who's enthralled to him personally and in terms of his clothes?
Well, you know, I think some of it is perhaps just personal aesthetic preference, but I also think that very much from the beginning of Michelle Obama's time in the East Wing, she has been a champion of younger designers, those designers who are less known, those who are just starting out or who have smaller businesses. So I think in many ways her track record really speaks to a point of view and a, you know, for lack of a better word, a sort of philosophy about the fashion industry that she has, I think, been very true to. Although just recently she did wear one of Oscar de la Renta's dresses to an event in celebration of the American fashion industry.
Robin, I want to step back and ask you about some earlier first ladies, but just following up on that, it's the case that you wrote in your column this morning about Oscar de la Renta that he had a taste, he wasn't afraid of controversy, and he sort of took Michelle Obama to task. Just tell that story about how the two of them ended up in some conflict over what she decided to wear to a state dinner, I believe, for the Chinese a couple years ago.
Well, it was a state dinner at the White House for China, and she chose a red Alexander McQueen dress for the evening. And Alexander McQueen is a London-based design house. And Oscar de la Renta essentially said that he felt that she had missed an opportunity to highlight the best of American design at this moment where the world's attention was on the White House, and in particular on her. And obviously, you know, no one particularly wants to be criticized for what they have chosen to wear, but You know, I think that Oscar's comments need to sort of be taken in the context out of which he came of age as a designer. And he really came to his stature at a time when the American fashion industry was really not much to speak of. You know, everything was essentially being designed and decided in Paris. And the American industry at that time was copying Paris. And there was an entire fashion economy on 7th Avenue that was predicated on copying Paris. And Oscar was among those early designers who were able to put American design on the map, who were able to bring American designers out of the back rooms and give them a voice, and they became names on a label. And so I think in some visceral way, he was still sort of fighting for the respect of the American fashion industry. And I do think felt very sincerely that an American first lady should, on the biggest occasions, wear an American brand.
Robin, the guy did quality work, and there's no doubt that's a big part of why so many first ladies and celebrities wanted to wear his clothes. But personally, what did he do to relate to, spend time with the Clintons, the Bushes, the Reagans in a way that made them think of him not just as hired help designing their clothes, but as a friend?
Well, I mean, he was absolutely an incredibly charming guy. I mean, as comments have come in from various members of the fashion industry, one of the words that comes up repeatedly is gentleman. And he was a gentleman in sort of that old school way. I mean, the last time that I interviewed him, he apologized to me for having taken off his tie. And, you know, I mean, who apologizes for taking off a tie? And which I thought was very sort of charming. And there was a certain charisma to him. But, you know, and I would really underscore also that despite all of that sort of seeming formality, he was a lot of fun. I mean, he could dish and gossip, and, you know, he loved music, and he, you know, he would dance and sing. So he was a fun guy to be around. And I think for a lot of the first ladies, you know, I mean, he donated to Republicans and Democrats. And so his sort of his politics pretty much stayed out of fashion. You know, he was a designer first and foremost. And I can recall that when Laura Bush came to him for her inaugural gown, for the second one, he commented that he was a bit surprised that she had done so because he was so closely associated with Hillary Clinton. But fashion trumped politics.
Robin, you mentioned Hillary Clinton. We don't have that much long here, but I just want to ask you, I had a speech back in April. Secretary Clinton said of Oscar de la Renta, this man has been working for more than 20 years to turn me into a fashion icon year in and year out. He's never given up. Do you think he's succeeded yet in turning her into a fashion icon?
I think that she has put up a good fight. So no, I don't think that he has succeeded, but I think that there are probably a lot of other qualities that he admired in her.
Fantastic. Robin Givhan, the Washington Post fashion critic, thank you so much for being here. Up next, as Selena Meyer would say, we're going to talk to some normals after this.
Bloomberg's With All Due Respect is brought to you by BP, proud to be America's largest energy investor.
When folks think about what they get from Alaska, they think salmon and energy. But the energy BP produces up here creates something else as well. Jobs all over America. Engineering and innovation jobs, advanced safety systems and technology, shipping and manufacturing. Across the United States, BP supports more than 250,000 jobs. When we set up operation in one part of the country, people in other parts go to work. That's not a coincidence. It's one more part of our commitment to America.
The Perceptions change and evolve. In a recent Bloomberg Audience Insights report, more and more IT decision makers evaluated Android as a secure platform for large-scale business operations. In the survey, 72% of IT decision makers said they had deployed an Android device as part of a bring-your-own-device initiative. Among them, more than 9 in 10 had deployed an Android device from Samsung. One reason they trust Samsung Android devices is the Knox security platform. 79% believe Knox is extremely or very useful for application security, with 78% mirroring that sentiment for malware protection. Samsung is in the unique position to offer security that is deeply rooted in hardware and constantly moves forward to help business realize the full potential of mobility.
Introducing the new and improved Bloomberg app for your iPhone and iPad. Financial markets change even when you're away from your desk. Bloomberg gives you a snapshot of what's moving, plus breaking news, video, and sophisticated portfolio management tools. Download the free Bloomberg application and stay ahead wherever you are. Also available on Android, BlackBerry, and Windows Phone.
Like everyone else, we've been talking a lot on this program about Ebola. Yesterday, the story dominated the news, and we decided to take a look at how differently our friends at MSNBC and Fox News are covering this big story. As you'll see on this, as with so much else, they appear to be reporting on parallel universes. Let's roll the tape.
We have some good news. A landmark day in the fight against Ebola here in the U.S. 43 of the individuals being monitored for the virus were cleared today.
You think that event that has the possibility to mutate, or that there might be enough infection within the lungs that if somebody, it could be airborne.
We are at this point getting around to some good news about this terrible story.
Make sure that they spray you with chlorine.
Okay, so spray you with chlorine.
Spraying with you chlorine.
Okay.
Emory Hospital says the anonymous patient they had been treating there since September 9th is finally free of the virus and well enough to go home.
Then the nightmare scenario would actually be if an Ebola-infected terrorist blew himself up in a crowded area, spreading infected tissue and turning it into a hot zone. So these are things that could actually happen, and we have to be very careful. We have to be worried about it.
Okay, so on one side, everything is great. There's zero risk and the world is all wonderful. On the other side, we have a terrorist who's infected himself with Ebola, blowing himself up at a shopping mall and bringing about Richard Preston's worst nightmare. Mark, you are down in Nashville and you talked to a bunch of people who are not on cable television today. I know you've seen a really stark red-blue divide, but one that is a little bit perhaps more measured and a little bit saner than what we sometimes see in the media.
Yeah, John, I went to Ellison's Soda Shop, founded in 1939. Rather than talk to cab drivers, I decided to go to a diner, very original, and talk to people. I was incredibly struck. Everyone I talked to was either clearly self-identified conservative or liberal, incredibly knowledgeable about current events and about politics, but also, as you said, much more civil in their nature of their disagreements, the way they express them, than you normally see on cable news. Politically, how would you describe yourself?
Pretty conservative.
And I heard you say before you're a conservative.
Yes, sir.
You said you're a Democrat. What does that mean to you?
Well, it means that I'm concerned about decisions that involve people over, let's say, businesses.
I believe in less governmental control. I believe in lower taxes. I think we have too much governmental spending.
I consider myself more of a conservative than a Republican because there's a number of Republicans that have been on the Hill that are not what I would consider conservatives.
I think that if no matter which side you're on, whether it be Republican or Democrat, I think if more people on either side of the aisle were willing to cross over for the good of the American people, that our country would be doing awesome.
I'm sure you think Obamacare is liberal, but what else is he liberal about?
I guess the gay marriage thing, but I feel like a true Republican shouldn't care about that. The separation of church and state, do I think it's right or wrong, is one question. Do I think that the government should be able to control it? No, I don't. That's something they shouldn't really infringe upon. It's too personal.
I do understand there's a balance, and there's a time that I actually voted for Republican governor for the state because of what he stood for. So
Who was
I'm
that?
Not
Who
so
was
that? Far.
Which Republican?
Winfield Dunn.
Nowadays, you listen to the candidates and what they speak of, and the majority of their advertisement is trash on the other side. And at the end, I'm always like, yeah, but what do you stand for? I still don't know where you stand.
What makes a good biscuit?
The fluff inside, nice crust on the outside, and just the way, you know, that's just a culture. The South has always had excellent biscuits and gravy, grits and whatnot.
I had one earlier. These are pretty good. I'd fly here, I think, just for the biscuits. John, everybody I talked to, regardless of political leanings, loved the biscuits. But look, I was so pleasantly surprised. These were all people really interested in politics, concerned about the country. But everyone was civil. Everyone was respectful. It was quite something. I was really pleased.
Yeah, I was going to say, in addition to making me hungry, that spot made me feel optimistic. You know, we often talk about as we travel around that the country is a lot less polarized and a lot less divisive than the politicians that are elected to represent it. And that seemed to me to show that not only were people civil, but there was a lot of heterodox opinion expressed there. You had conservatives who were saying, well, I'm conservative, but I don't think the government should mess around with gay marriage. And that's always really comforting to see, too, people who are even within themselves acknowledging the contradictions in their own points of view and being non-doctrinaire.
The one thing that divided people was the president. He is clearly the lightning rod in the midterm elections, yeah. No doubt.
Well, there's no question about that, and you know, people have strong views on that, but very optimistic and very kind of comforting thing to see from you down there. Thanks for doing that, Mark. We'll be right back.
A remote that lives on your phone. More Wi-Fi in more places. A movie library you can take wherever you go. Internet speeds that have gotten faster 13 times in 12 years. At Comcast, we're creating new possibilities. Together with Time Warner Cable, we'll be able to extend those to more people. Comcast and Time Warner Cable. Together is better for more people.
Breitling, instruments for professionals.
Your business requires on-time payroll processing, affordable health benefits, workers' compensation, managing government compliance, and employee performance management. Insperity's Workforce Optimization is a suite of HR services that takes care of all of this and more, helping your company run better, grow faster, and make more money. It's what we do. Insperity, inspiring business performance.
Koch Industries started in the heartland, and we've expanded to nearly every state. Today, that's more than 60,000 American jobs. You may not always see our name on the products you use, but we help make better food, clothing, shelter, technologies, and other necessities. Here, we build on each other's ideas to create more opportunities for people everywhere. Together, we are Coke.
We are only on television a half an hour a day, but we are live 24/7 on BloombergPolitics.com. Tonight, we got the World Series Game 1. You going to be watching down there from Nashville, Mark?
John, I'll be subject to the tender mercies of three great American institutions, Slingbox, Delta Airlines, and Go-Go Wi-Fi. We'll see.
Awesome. Okay. On the web right now, Margaret Taleb, great story. Go look at that. On the show tomorrow, Mark and I will talk with Senator Ted Cruz. But up next, we have Bloomberg's Stephanie Ruhle. We'll be sitting down with billionaire activist and investor Carl Icahn for a special look inside what that titan is betting on and against right now.
partnerships occur when both share a passion for improving, for growing in harmony. Speak from the heart and respect the other. Feeling of being comfortable, of being open, that creates the true partnership, which ensures the greatest success.